this is the Q Report. Yeah!
All right.
Nice.
You like that one?
Back in action. Good.
It's a Sunday. I'm here sitting in the studio with Mark Marabara.
Hello.
And Ed Grant.
Hey, Patrick. How's it going?
We also have many other guests. So how's it going, guys? How's your quotidian life been since last week?
It's been quite quotidian. I was just reaching for a slice of pizza, and I had to come back to the mic here.
I guess
I'm not supposed to eat on air. Is that the official rule?
No, we encourage it here.
Can you hear me smacking and enjoying my pizza?
Yes, yeah. You sound like a very happy person when you're shoving food down your hole.
As it turns out, I am.
You always have a very elegant style about you.
We need to get this out of the way, just so it's not, you know, awkward or anything. But we have to wish Mark happy birthday.
Oh, you don't actually. It's tomorrow, but thank you. I appreciate
that. Happy birthday.
Thank you.
I'll stop doing sound effects. I promise.
Yeah, I don't know what that's supposed to mean. Yes, another random day on the 1.5 billion people on the planet is tomorrow.
But it's, you know,
it's
for
mine.
You.
It's for you. Mm-hmm. It's while my mother's really celebrating.
How old are you?
I am still 42 today. Tomorrow will be 43. I will begin my 44th year tomorrow.
Your 44th summer?
My 43rd, yeah. I am Richard Petty coming up.
Nice.
Yeah. The winningest NASCAR race. Is he still the winningest?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. 43 is a
good one. I don't like American racing. They only turn in one direction. I think it's relatively boring.
I'm with you. It's all about endurance.
We're going to make that a
just like
one day.
Yeah, it's all about endurance.
So what's on the show today? Today we're talking about green building.
Green industry.
Industries, man. We're
taking the lead on LEED.
Yes. And Pat and Ed, we looked up LEED just to make sure to
we're talking out our ass.
They were talking about credit or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's
leadership.
Leadership
in
environment,
energy, and environmental design.
Thank you.
There you go.
Wow. Yeah. I think we should end the show right there. I'm sorry, that's perfect.
Everybody's down taking their notes down.
Yeah, a little call and response.
So this building, actually, we are broadcasting in two shipping containers, which I'd love to ask our panel of experts.
It's a good
point. It's a very green technology, this, because it's a ready-built structure. You can stack them 10 high. I mean, the big thing is, you know, what
interior
materials do you use to build it out?
Yeah,
know,
and I have to say,
reclaimed wood.
The Luon ceiling that we have is not green, not even remotely green. Hey, you got to call it as you see it, there, my
but
friend.
But why is Luon? I would think it's very thin wood, so it actually ends up being, you know, using less of an environmental footprint.
No, it's because Luon comes from raping of tropical rainforest trees.
Don't tag that.
We could tag rape, right?
Well, sorry, man. Yeah. It's like, but the walls are reclaimed, which is nice.
Yeah.
Right?
And Mark, last question, how's Doily? How's the baby?
She's good, growing.
Do you have a name picked out yet?
We do, Antoinette. My mother's middle name. My mother's passed away. It's her middle name.
Okay.
And so that's a large name to fit into, as everybody says, but we're expecting big things, of course.
Very cool, very cool. Well, I'm really excited about this show. I mean, our first guest is Curtis Wayne. Hey, Curtis.
Hey there, how are you?
Thanks for being here.
I like this. It's like being inside a tomato carton, only turned upside down.
Yes. That's exactly what it's like. So tell us, Curtis, tell us what you do and, you know, a little bit about the whole world you come from.
I'm an architect, and my specialty over the last 10 years or longer is helping other architects construct their dreams. You'd think that in this age of information that the accumulated knowledge of the centuries would be instantly available. But what we find is that because it's a computer-driven environment now, the people who should be learning, the younger architects and designers, are plugged into their individual computers, transfixed by the screen with an iPod soundtrack. And the old paradigm that existed in the 20th century when I learned of talking while you're drawing and learning from the older people doesn't exist any longer. So we have a profusion of computer generated stuff that's not been vetted by anybody, that's instantly available, gets plugged into drawings without any attention to how do these different systems go together. How does
sound familiar, Ed?
No, not at all. Not at all.
Beforehand, we were talking about the problem in our industry, entire construction industry, as a matter of fact, where there's too much information of the wrong kind. So my focus is on helping my colleagues and owners.
What do they get wrong?
Everything.
Thank you.
And seriously, it's.
You mean they don't build new structures with the same, image and feel and look, understanding of what came before, or they're just hurting the environment? I mean,
60 or 70 years ago,
it's inefficient.
We really had master builders as architects. They understood all the different trades, how the trades go together, how the connections need to work. Mm-hmm. That knowledge is increasingly lost.
Yeah. I mean, I honestly am surprised that half of the new buildings in the city just don't fall down. With the level of attention sometimes going into it and craftsmanship going into the making of them.
Well, you should
constantly.
Well, luckily there's a lot of old buildings, so there's a lot of good craftsmanship still left.
Well, that's true. Well, now my own experience has been with new buildings in New York over the last 6 or 7 years. I've reviewed at least 300 projects.
Wow.
I was representing construction lenders. Now, of course, that's a moribund field right now. There's no money.
As the open pit across the street from me attests,
yes,
they
yes.
lost their funding. It just that was supposed to be 40 stories. Now it's just pool of
the other building across from you is
was supposed to be the same.
Yeah, no, but the one that is built is essentially
empty.
An empty pit.
Yeah, it's empty.
It's
that's
just
true.
A tall empty pit
with nice appointments.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, New York will now have all these ghost towers, which will, who knows what they'll be repurposed for.
Yeah.
It's a whole new potential here. Right. You have a beautiful new empty building. What do you do with it?
Yeah. And what are they trying to do? Something new rather than something classic? Is it like the effort to break new ground? And so they're like, I got to do something that's never been done before. And
that's not the problem. The problem is that everyone was so busy for so long, architects and engineers and owners, that they knew that their contract documents is the proper term of art, that their documents were faulty, and they just push it off, say, well, we'll figure it out during construction. So now
we'll fix it in post in my industry.
Well, exactly.
Once it's built. Yeah.
Shoot a lot of footage.
That's right.
Let the editors figure it out.
Right, that's right. Okay, that works in my field.
Well, the contractors ended up being the editors, and on almost every project we saw.
the contractors, man. No, often it ends up under the poor dude in the field actually doing the work.
For all our listeners out there, let's just do a quick little primer between Ed and Curtis, and just tell us from what to what. So tell us the process from
the production chain.
Yeah, just tell us the production chain, how it works. So I want to design a building. What happens next?
Well, you hire, say, IM Pay, and while he's flying on the shuttle from Washington to New York,
I'm building a museum.
He'll sketch out something on the back of an envelope.
Okay.
You know, a dunning letter from his structural engineer, whom he hasn't paid in 6 months.
Right.
And then he'll present it to his...
This analogy works for Gary, too, probably, right?
Oh, absolutely. Although Gary, I think Gary prefers to deal with tin snips and beer cans.
Right. That's
even too much work. I mean, come on. It's a napkin.
Then it goes to the designer. And it goes to junior designers who refine it. The master comes in, looks at drawings pinned up on the wall. It's just like architecture school. Eventually it goes to a senior project manager who tries to put together the drawings that show how the builders will build it. Goes out to bid.
Bid for materials and labor.
To build the work.
All the subs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, of course, then the bid comes back with a list as long as your arm of exclusions. Like,
we're not responsible.
We're not doing this, and if you asked us to do it, it's going to be 21% more than it's going to cost us. And clarification saying we can't get titanium panels in New York this week. How about aluminum instead? Mm-hmm. And then it gets
built.
Well, then it goes for a building permit, and zoning looks at it.
Wow.
Neighborhood community in New York City, the community board may have a say.
Mm-hmm.
You may need a zoning variance. You definitely need landmarks to look at it if it's in a landmark zone.
Wow.
Then construction starts, and they make a big hole in the ground.
How long is that already? That's like, is that 9 months or a year if you're lucky, right?
Oh, we're years. We're talking years.
Years before ground is even broken.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Wow.
And then start digging. If it's going to be a very tall building, it will have very deep foundations down to, hopefully, bedrock.
Which is New York City's famous for, right? Has a lot of good bedrock.
A lot of good bedrock, but then out here.
It depends on where it is in the city.
Right. Out here, we're sitting on a sandbar.
Yeah.
So
in Brooklyn, where we are.
One of the exciting things that you may discover when you dig is that there's an underground stream, and your hole that you've dug starts filling up with water.
As you're digging your hole, the building next door suddenly develops a crack running up it.
That happens all the time.
Yeah, and so you bracing goes up, people move out.
There's a hotel downtown in Manhattan under construction, and the site was filled in the 1740s. It was in the Hudson River before that.
Wow.
And they started digging, taking all the proper precautions. They underpinned the adjacent building, which means they stuck some more concrete under it. And as they started to withdraw the water, because the Hudson River was coming up inside their site, the building started to cave in. It just, water comes out almost like a mudslide of adjacent construction was headed into the hole.
Curtis, we got to take a break, and we'll come right back with that.
I want to ask about Indian burial grounds and if Indian burial grounds come back and haunt the building.
And we are just veering so off topic today.
I had a long night last night.
But you've got to understand that getting anything built in New York City can be just an unbelievable task. So
we'll be back. We'll be back.
Introduce Chris Damon. Chris wanted to everybody to rest assured that buildings themselves aren't going to fall down. I was being a little flip in my comments about it, and they actually have to pass.
But
tests.
The walls might fall off. But
Chris, if you're going to be trying to tell us a little bit about what you do and who you are.
Okay, I am a sustainability consultant with Stephen Winter Associates here in New York City. Okay. And in a previous life, I was a structural engineer. I've also been a civil engineer, and I've worked as an architect. And so now I pretty much wrap all what I've done previously and give architects and owners and developers a hard time in order to try and make their buildings more sustainable.
Excellent.
Huh. It's amazing the building industry, as we were talking about earlier with Curtis, it's so long. And as everybody knows, very materials intensive. So, as they say, as energy, regarding greening, as this trend is going in society, buildings are take the most energy to build, and also, of course, to sustain once they're up. So how do you know, and for you, both of you guys, how do you sort of start address such large issues with such a long-term proposition? I mean, especially in New York, these buildings are up for literally a century or more.
It really depends on the type of building that you're trying to build. What are you really trying to accomplish? In the case of the shipping container that we're in, this is repurposing something that's already had a life, and it's quite sustainable because you just need a small space somewhere on a lot in the middle of Brooklyn. If you're trying to build a museum or you're trying to build an office tower, you really need to build for longevity. And the fact that you're using resources, you know, virgin resources, virgin steel even, you know, gets diminished because the building's going to be there hopefully for at least 100 years. And, you know, many of our buildings in New York are already 100 years old.
Right.
And many of them have at least another 100 years in them. So that's not necessarily where you're going to have a lot of impact. But the use of the building, the energy that the building uses while it's occupied, tends to really have a huge, huge impact.
So that's where it's actually a lot of the focus is now green buildings, is how they use energy, heating, cooling, and stuff over their lifespan more so.
Well, sure, on an ongoing basis.
Yeah.
But
one of the key things we can do as consultants, as architects, is to make sure that when you're not using a room, it's not being illuminated, for example. Mm-hmm. So building-wide energy management systems are becoming very, very prevalent because you can cut down the amount of energy consumption through turning off the lights, mm-hmm. using more daylight, using a mix of artificial illumination with daylight. I mean, I notice in here you have a couple of lights on. You probably don't need them. Human being.
Because small
waters, though.
That particular issue right there is why in our practice we typically recommend that daylight sensors always be used. And it seems like, well, why don't you just turn off the lights? But, you know, we're in a place here, people are sustainably minded, but the lights still are on, even because when the light is on, you don't notice it as much.
Right.
And
I have a question. Like, obviously, the environmental impact is huge, but in terms of the economic, does it really save money, or does the whole implementation of this end up costing just as much as it would have if you had wasted the stuff, but you're helping the environment?
That's a really good question. The payback on a
long-term, short-term
energy management system is probably around 12 years. Is that your experience?
Or less.
Mm.
Or less.
Depends to the extent that control different systems. There are systems that will diminish the amount of ventilation in an unoccupied room. That helps.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Now,
if you're looking at, we're talking about a cost payback and the amount of the energy saved. Well, in a lot of ways, it really depends on how heavily subsidized is your energy cost. And the energy in the United States, for as long as I can remember, has been subsidized because we're not paying for...
Whoa, back up. Our energy costs are subsidized? That sounds socialist, and I thought we weren't a socialist country until Obama became president.
We've been a socialized country for a long time.
Socialized risk.
You mean in terms of the cost of generation plants being taken off the books in terms of a factor for the cost of energy?
Well, you know... The amount that you pay for the energy, it typically pays for the fuel and of producing that energy. It typically pays for the transportation to get that fuel wherever it is. It pays for a lot of the infrastructure. It doesn't pay for the war that we're currently in Iraq, which is mostly because of oil, or, you know, our influence in that region is mostly due to our addiction to oil, and that's not paid for. The health costs that we deal with, the acid rain that coal-burning plants are making, these huge coal ash piles that are throughout the country that are
collapsing,
you know, have been deemed so, they're such a high risk to our society that we can't let the public know where they are because they're terrorist threats. So, you know, those sorts of issues that we've kind of been sweeping under the rug are... They've been considered externalities. And when you look at the externalities...
They're bulging under the carpet.
Yes.
But they're all part of the big picture of sustainability.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I've heard in the past, like, the new all-glass skyscrapers, you know, there's a back and forth on... In the past, I guess they were horribly inefficient. and energy-wise, but the new ones aren't so bad from what I understand. Like, glass is more insulating. You're looking at me like, no, that's a complete...
This is a huge issue within my professional community. We actually just had they called it a showdown between mass versus glass. Mass being mass walls that are typically concrete masonry units with brick. A lot of apartment buildings in New York have a mass type of construction versus glass, you know, the sheer glass curtain walls. Mm-hmm. And there's really no issue. In both cases, the walls have benefits and they also have a lot of drawbacks. It's true that the old glass skyscrapers, especially single-paned windows, they were horrible in the amount of energy that they consumed and the environmental quality in the spaces. Today, there's been a lot of technology. There's coatings that you put on the glass that keep the heat out, and everyone uses insulated glass units now, which helps a lot. But really, in the end, you can't get glass to perform all that well, and a big problem is not so much the glass, but the structure that holds the glass together, which is, in almost every case, aluminum, and aluminum conducts heat very, very well.
Mm. And takes a great amount of electricity to produce.
So
yes.
Regarding the efficiencies of energy in building, is it more in the materials when you're doing the building, or is it after the building is up, or is it both in some way? Well, what's the balance of that? Meaning, you're selecting your materials and your process, as Curtis was saying, years before a hole is even dug, and then 12 years to get back the greening technology. So where are those efficiencies?
Well, often greening technologies have a payback. Sometimes they're cheaper to begin with, and so there is no payback. And other times the payback is within 5 or 7 years. And, 12 years is pretty much probably for a retrofit condition on an existing building.
Mm.
Yeah, what about that, too? Like, in New York, you see a lot of factories being converted into lofts and condos and stuff. Is there, benefits to redoing a building versus a new building? Mm-hmm. Or because of all the new technologies available,
right,
is a new building potentially better?
You know, opinions differ. It's almost like religion. You have one group that says,
redo
this is true, and another group that says, no, that is true. The repurposing of an industrial building is, in terms of sustainability, a very good investment, because concrete, the steel, the masonry that's there has been produced. The environmental cost of producing it
has been done.
Has been amortized.
Do you want to, can you speak to that, actually, the carbon footprint of producing cement?
Ah, one of your favorite topics,
yeah,
I believe.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah.
It's pretty high. However, over the last several years, the composition of concrete has been changing. We're using more post-industrial product, fly ash, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting about that...
But that's from coal, burning coal for power, or...
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Sure.
So a horrible way to get energy.
That stuff, we're
still reusing it.
It would go in a dump.
Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is that it's now connected in a big circle back to the way that the Romans made concrete. And they used volcanic ash, a pozzolan material that helps. In their case, they were using limestone that they burned, turned into a paste, rehydrated it, and made concrete that was very stiff. And now in the 21st century, we're making concrete that has more of the qualities of longevity that the Romans had 2,500 years ago.
Mm-hmm. It was amazing that the Romans were considered more right, and they did everything better, and then things went downhill until maybe like 1700. Although things must not have been that much better back then, but that is wild. That
well,
we're
they
back to
they
that.
Did
the
like
Romans
to eat off of lead.
Yeah, and they also didn't build buildings that are thousands of feet tall.
Right,
that's true.
Right.
And they
were great
had,
architects.
Well, they did create the first dictator, one of the greatest
first dictatorships.
empires, and they tried to pay for wars with other armies. So we do have some of the things that were still.
Well, where is the cutting edge of this revolution, green revolution with building, coming from? Is it from the States, or is it from places like Scandinavia or France or Italy?
Well, how you deal with things is going to be determined by what climate you're in. And so in Germany and Scandinavia, and in Canada, their technology is much, much ahead of ours in terms of dealing with the cold climate.
Okay.
But I don't know if you've noticed, in New York, it gets really, really cold and also gets really, really hot. And so that technology on how to deal with the heat isn't necessarily there. And so the technology that can really help us the most is an old technology, which is a caulk gun. And the other one is relatively newer, but it's spray foam. And
well, spray foam is a wonderful thing.
We have spray foam all up in these pipes and stuff like that. That's how we filled in the empty spaces.
It has a very high insulating value. Mm-hmm. It keeps water vapor out. So it
uses products that you wouldn't otherwise use in other places.
What do you mean?
The foam itself?
Oh, the foam itself is really toxic shit.
It's, yeah, right.
They're working on that too. There's a soy-based one, but it's the fact that you can spray this in and it expands as it cures. Expands and then cures. So it fills voids that in the past were never
filled.
Space
shuttle technology.
The glue, on
the
other hand, is not sustainable because I forgot like a week's worth of what I did because I was like gluing all the things. I mean, glue was bad.
Some glue.
That's all I can say.
Bad.
Glue bad.
Well, but there's.
If you learn not to huff while you're doing that work.
Yeah, don't open the can and just sit there.
Exactly. Well,
but I think back to your original question of where did this trend come from? Mm-hmm. In the late 1970s, there was talk in Germany about climate change. And Germany does not usually get very hot in the summertime. And the whole notion of having to install air conditioning went against their sense of the proper fit and balance of things in the world. And so we saw buildings that were very efficient at natural cooling in Germany. And some of those early buildings with double and triple layers of glass with internal louvers that kept insolation, that is the sunlight that comes in through a window and heats up the space to a minimum. Mm-hmm. Now these are kind of gadgety buildings here. So a lot of electronics that is involved in manipulating all of these doodads all over the building. But then the Germans are very good at that. And Siemens
needs to build something.
Is one of the leaders in control systems of this nature.
Very interesting. Well, we're going to take a break and come back to this for one more segment before we talk about a very interesting topic, green production.
Green film production.
Awesome. Back on the Q Report, broadcasting from Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm Patrick Martins.
Mark Marabella.
And I'm Ed Grant.
And this was brought to you by Hearst Ranch, which actually, we might talk about this at the end of the segment. I think they had one of the first post-September 11th green buildings. They're one on 58th Street and 7th Avenue.
Yeah.
They're very tall, water, I mean, built out of triangles. That was you guys?
Our company was involved in that project.
Wow. I got a tour of that because they're sponsors of the network. Amazing building. I mean, just by building in triangles versus squares, they already remove the need for millions of tons of steel, and water falls off and supports the trees on this block. Very interesting
beautiful.
Stuff.
Chris, but that has glass and masonry, and both. On the inside, it has masonry, doesn't it, that building? Isn't it built on an older building?
This is the
it's
one
built inside of a shell of an older building right. that is much, much smaller than the new building.
So you get the best of both worlds on that.
Oh, side. I'm sorry. This is on 57th, 58th, 8th Avenue. Yeah. Oh, next door to one of the worst condo conversions in New York City right now. That would be Sheffield 57.
What do you want to know about it? I was involved very deeply with that project.
We'll talk about that after, because so was I.
That has very little to do with LEED, as a matter of fact.
Nothing to do with it. I was also involved with 25 Broad.
I see.
Anyway. So now, if you're not a mogul, and I was thinking, if you're not really thinking about buying a building or doing anything like that, what can our listeners at home, like the average Joe, it's like, I want to make a change. I mean, what would you guys recommend for the average guy in an apartment in New York City or in the Midwest in a farmhouse or something? What can they do?
Well, the best way to reduce the energy you use to heat and cool your home, which is probably where most of the energy is going, would be to seal the building up. And it's kind of like if you go camping, the first step that you do is you put the tent up, and that's going to keep the elements off of you. But the next thing you do to try and keep yourself warm is you seal it up. You zip up the doors and close everything up. And then you would start thinking about maybe insulating the tent, but that'd be down the road. So before you start trying to pack insulation everywhere, you really need to cut off the amount of air that's coming into and out of the building accidentally. Mm-hmm. And we've relied historically on getting ventilation, fresh air, into buildings through these mistakes. And the new motto is to seal tight and ventilate right. And so seal the building up as tight as you can and then have controlled ventilation, whether that is, cracking a window somewhere and having an exhaust fan in your bathroom. But that will reduce the amount of air that's coming in and out. Normally, you get a lot more than you would possibly need.
Yeah, I love how people in New York in the older buildings, like the six-story walk-ups, in the winter control their interior temperature by opening the window.
Yes, yeah. That's called a New York thermostat.
That's right, exactly. That's right, it's true. In my office in Tribeca, it's like that too.
Yeah.
Open the window because you can't control the radiators.
You can't control the radiators in the old steam systems.
And it takes about $50, I think, to put a thermostatic control on a radiator. It's pretty straightforward and easy process.
Can I ask you guys about the old, a lot of the old buildings in New York too, that I have friends who have apartments, had the old air shafts. Actually, even the Viacom building has an air shaft, fresh air shaft. Are those good? Or I mean, that was an old sort of...
That was a reaction to the tenements.
Yeah, right.
And they don't really provide fresh air.
They don't?
No.
Robert Moses.
He didn't have anything to do with that.
Else? No, that's not him.
He had everything to do with the concrete.
Yeah. No, a fresh air shaft in a walk-up building really is not giving you any fresh air. But to follow on what Chris said, once you seal up your house or your apartment, that leads to the next problem, which is bad air quality. Hmm. Even if you have an open window in New York, there's no guarantee that the diesel fumes from the bus that idles outside your window isn't coming in and giving you really foul living conditions.
Right.
So once you have sealed up your environment, the quality of air in your apartment, to a great extent, can be dependent on the rugs that you have, your furniture. Is the foam in your IKEA sofa exgassing stuff that you don't want to be breathing? Not incidentally, the...
Fire retardant?
There are fire retardants that do exgas, yeah.
The carpets, the factory-made, mass-produced ones, those are horrible, right?
Yes.
Especially wall-to-wall with their backing and stuff.
Some of them. There's a company, Interface Carpets. This isn't really a plug for them, but their CEO was approached by some environmentalists quite a few years ago and basically made to realize how horrible his entire industry was.
Yeah.
And he took the lead and he pretty much changed his company in the direction that they're going. And they are sort of leading the way, and they do huge mass-produced wall-to-wall carpeting.
He could be seen in The Corporation, I think, the documentary. I think he was in that, if you're familiar with that documentary. Yeah.
I believe he was.
Yeah. Because there are certain applications where that type of carpeting and rug is very important. But, it still doesn't beat shearing, goat or something and then hand weaving it as far as your impact. But
I think for an average interested lay person to have an idea about what can be done is to look almost as a case study at what the Battery Park City Housing Authority has required for their new apartment houses, where they'll be using...
How many are there in that building?
There are many, many, many buildings, but they all have to conform to a set of environmental guidelines that pretty much exceed LEED certified requirements. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, my company put the guidelines together, so
all right.
So I do agree.
And so apartments there will have low VOC bamboo flooring or natural wall coverings, high efficiency filters on the ventilating systems, very, very large windows to encourage the use of daylight, a master switch so you can kill all the lighting circuits on the way out. And
actually, Anoop, could you turn our lights off? I would feel bad.
It's yeah, especially because they're incandescent lights too. It's, I mean, doubly embarrassing.
I
know,
really, I don't like the temperature on the
Heritage
green ones,
Radio
actually.
Network is evil.
Yeah, I'm surprised you don't have.
You don't like the light temperature on him, or
the temperature,
the color temperature,
exactly, the color temperature. Well, yeah. That's quite variable on CFLs, and
that's
you can
good.
Get. You can get some CFLs that are almost as artificially warm as an incandescent light.
That's for those who don't know the Argyte, that's a compact fluorescent light.
Thank you.
Yep.
And tell us, with furniture, I mean, does it matter where I put my couch or whatever? I mean, are you talking about
places? Where you buy it?
Where you buy it and what they use in the manufacture of it?
What can they do with the furniture? I mean, are there companies, and where can people go to for more information if they wanted to, you know, build out a place?
Well, one of the companies that actually is better than most is actually IKEA, and they're Swedish and. They have a little bit of a different perspective. I won't say they're perfect, definitely.
Their meatballs certainly aren't.
No. And I don't know of any great resource off the top of my head, but there's plenty of people out there, but most companies haven't really taken the lead on this. It's actually, carpet is a lot better. And for carpet, you can just look for Green Label Plus certified carpet.
Yeah, for...
In the price range, it's pretty much the same, and they also deal with rugs. And
is Heather Rug Company, do they sell that stuff? Rug Company?
Rug Company's product is 100% natural.
And it's, what certification, exactly. What labels mean something in this industry? I mean, if you see a company that has...
FSC is important for furniture.
For wood, FSC, especially
what's
if it's
that stand for?
Forest Stewardship Council.
Okay.
For basically certifies through a...
chain of custody...
That
process.
The wood, the veneers came from
fair
a sustainable,
trade, kinda.
Sustainable forests. Yeah,
I don't believe FSC deals with trade issues. I think it's strictly about sustainability.
It is.
But in the case of using any exotic wood, that's definitely a good label that you want to look for.
And what else? What about? I've always been
Energy
amazed.
Strong.
Like I saw Al Gore's thing, you know, and it didn't really have that many solutions in it. You know, and I always thought, like, it would be best served if there could be some government agency that would say these 700 companies.
We're getting into that, and that was LEED is the first attempt of that.
Yeah, but
well, as was just mentioned, Energy Star. The Department of Energy has come up with Energy Star pretty much as a result of the first energy crisis that we had, or the one in the 70s.
Exactly.
That's not necessarily the first.
Our government's going to be, I think, lacking far behind. The European Union... last couple of years adopted new rules. I don't know if they've gone into effect yet. That will be draconian as far as the materials used to produce varnishes. I think their particle board's going to have to be zero emitting for formaldehyde, all this stuff. And that hasn't happened yet. But in America, private industry, I think, has stepped up. Columbia Products,
that's the system.
They make a lot of plywood. And they now have a zero VOC plywood, so that's important.
You mean like the particle board made in the trailers for Katrina?
Well, this is not particle board. Particle board's evil. This is plywood.
Right. It can't be worse than Llewellyn or whatever.
Luan.
I think it's pretty. And
I can't believe our thing
is
under attack.
Here.
No, Heritage Radio Network is the real victim here. No, God,
Heritage Radio Network is they're putting out the real story, though, aren't you?
Well, I always thought we have nothing to hide.
We don't back down.
For just a moment, I'd just like to answer a question that hasn't been posed yet, which is, what are the benefits for people to have a more sustainable or green
good
environment?
Clean and fair.
Well, one of the things that I've seen over my career is that as industry has gone forward with exotic chemistry in products, also at the same time, many, many, many more people seem to have asthma, and children seem to have huge allergy problems, which we didn't have in the 50s growing up. And
we weren't surrounded by antibacterial everything. You know, our parents just kind of threw us out. We got dirty, put stuff in our mouth.
There was a recent blog by a pediatrician on the Huffington Post about basically autism, and the idea that vaccines cause autism has pretty much been refuted in most scientific circles.
Yes.
But environmental toxins are something that could definitely be a culprit and need to be investigated.
Definitely part of the problem. I mean, we were just on our last main course with Katie Kiefer talking about bee colony collapses, and that's pesticides. I mean, as if, you know, technology, which is supposed to serve mankind, I mean, it's so ironic, just the world of hurt and problems and problems and problems that they start. But I mean, of course there are problems.
It's also accumulative. It's not just, it's over years and years of that. Those heavy metals, they just sit in the body. They don't go away.
And we're like the first generation that's literally leading a whole life within that absurdity, be it saccharin or, you know, pesticides or what we're talking about today.
Mm-hmm. And we try to improve things and use new materials. For example, now in many, many parts of the country, polyethylene tubing, or PEX, is legal for water supply. We're not positive that
nothing's coming off it.
Exactly. Also, the use of groundwater pumps for geothermal systems is not, in my mind, unless it's a closed loop where you're using the same coolant again and again and using the ground as a heat dump, that the pumps and the bearings and the fittings are not going to be polluting the groundwater.
Right.
Well, this has been very interesting. I mean, Curtis and Chris, I think you guys should be our resident experts for all the network and all the shows we have, and we're going to recommend that if the issue is an important one that you guys call in or come in, because it's absolutely something that we want to be tagging a lot of on our site, and you guys are absolute pioneers to be, you know, giving concrete change to the world.
Now, Patrick, in the future, I want our bumper music to be Talking Heads, because, you know, this network's all about architecture and food.
Okay, absolutely. You can pick your own songs. We'll have your own song that comes in, and live band, if you keep on coming on. But awesome. Well, Katie, thanks for getting Curtis on, and Chris.
Thank you, Chris.
Oh, and Chris, you did both right. Okay.
Yeah, no, it's
this
nice.
Is the Katie.
Thanks for having me.
Katie shows.
Yeah, no, this is really nice for me because I'm involved more on the end of it type of thing with casework and millwork, cabinets and stuff, and to talk about the issues on a much bigger scale, you know. And we didn't get to talk about my favorite one, which is concrete that cleans itself. But we'll get to that at another show.
All right. Well, we're going to come back, Mark, with someone.
Thanks.
We're coming back with someone.
Meredith Bergman.
Bergman, who's talk about greening of productions.
Green Media Solutions.
Thank you. flower for a Sana camota, salvaño mavrus, chasta mi sana camo. Από τη ζωή μόνα ξανά το δεδρύ αργά τα έχει από τη ζωή. Μόνα ξανά γίνηκε δεδρύ και το ποτίζω. Δεν τρίτσε το ποτίζω και στο μαγί του άστιανό πολυμερείς καθίζω. Με το κορμί μορτάκι, άιδες, με το κορμί μορτάκι στο κόσμο μην αφήσετε αγυρευτό σοκάκι.
Hi, we're back at the Q Report. I'm Mark Marabella.
I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Ed Grant.
Patrick, disguising your voice for some reason. We have...
What?
That was a fantastic segment. We had Curtis and Chris.
Very interesting.
Building trades, and in a similar trade, we now have for my little neck of the woods of the film production, we have Meredith Bergman coming on, who's recreating in Connecticut. Meredith, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, so, Meredith.
Hi. The sun finally came out up here.
I was going to ask you. It's gorgeous here in Brooklyn. How's it in Connecticut?
It's gotten much better.
That's very good nice. For the environment. You can turn your lights off now. We just learned.
Oh, I didn't have my lights on all morning.
She's using a landline too. No cellular. So Meredith. Meredith is from a company called Green Media Solutions, and she helps to green film productions, which, and Meredith, we're going to give a little primer for people who don't know how that works and how a set works. It's sort of like, as we were talking about before, building in like a little city, very similar to the building trades, as you, I don't know if you were listening before, Curtis and Chris describing what it is to, and Ed describing what it is to build and use those materials.
Yeah, if set is very much, building a production is very much like building a house. You rely on different industries, you know, to provide your basic needs. You're going to rely on energy and electric, travel and transportation, construction and art. You're going to have, you know, catering and craft, which is food, and then, you know, waste and recycling, and all those things are integral to the production. You'll have a pre-production period of about 10 to 12 weeks where you wrap up and, you know, ramp up to create the actual production, and during that time, you know, scripts are being refined, they're setting up production offices, vendors are being engaged, they're looking for places to shoot, and set designs are being solidified, and, you know, they're sort of finalizing the cast and getting all the travel arrangements made. And then about 2 weeks before, all that stuff becomes almost like a frenzy. Yeah. And then you have a period of actual production where it's, you know, principal photography is, I think, how some people refer to it, which can last anywhere from 8 to 12 weeks.
Yeah.
And those can be shot on a stage, and there are several actual studios actually out in Brooklyn. There's Brooklyn right. Stages and
Steiner.
There's Steiner.
Yeah, I
Steiner.
Live a block away from Steiner.
Yep.
It's an amazing operation there. Huge.
Steiner's very busy.
very busy, very busy, and really interesting to go visit. And then, you know, a movie can also be shot on location, which is sort of in the very public eye. And when you're shooting on location, you sort of have to, you know, recreate all those things that you've created on the stage out in public, which means bringing energy and craft and places to sit and people to rest and change all on location, which is a challenge in itself, especially
it's
in
immense.
New York.
So
it's
what
immense.
Are the what are the best ways to fix that? I mean, what are some of like what are the first three or five things you'll tell a movie like this is where you'll get your most bang for your eco buck?
Well, I mean, everything about, you know, conservation is about, you know, good planning. You know, every industry is wasteful as a result of a poor planning and lack of time. The film industry is not different. I mean, the better prepared you are, the more efficient you're going to be and the more you save. So always planning is the first.
Pre-production, pre-production predicts good production.
Yeah, this is Ed. I actually was with Mark on a shoot of his for one of his recent things.
Which was a relatively large shoot for me.
Yeah, I was doing the still photography during it. And it was my first experience in this world, and everybody was saying it, how well it went, and how everything, and I was just like, oh my God, that was the most inefficient, nightmarish thing in the world.
Yeah, it was Meredith, it's funny, because Ed was saying... Yeah, he saw a lot of people sort of sitting around in a bunch of tents. And
a lot of the same questions asked again, and where's Waldo and everything. And
but it was very efficient. I mean, from my sense, I was directing at that time, and it was, it went pretty well.
But I have to say, your initiative to make productions more green, I mean, that just seems like an unbelievably daunting task to me.
Although you are dealing with people who are probably open to the idea. I mean, Hollywood, documentary, people in New York and L.A.,
it's
right?
All about money. What are you talking about?
But I'm saying money, you know, brings
education. Well, you're
education.
Both right. I mean, you really are both right. It is people who are more, you know, a little, slight, you know, more open-minded. But it is, when it comes right down to it, a film industry, a film studio is a corporation. And it does come down to money. There are things, you know, just to go back to your first question, which is how do you make a greener production? There are things that you can look towards. You know, recycling and waste is a pretty easy, you know, give right now. Mm-hmm. You can find several companies out there that are willing to help you out and go that extra mile so that you're recycling efficiently. You can set up the production crews and the production office and locations people to help you set up while you're on a shoot out in public. There are also, you know, there are other initiatives like technology that you can engage. LEDs have become quite useful in the studio arena, where you're using about 10 to 15% of the energy you would with a regular incandescent. You know, that technology is not quite there when you're on location, but it's getting there. We have gotten people to use biodiesel on some of our shoots, where they're actually saving money. You know, the thing is about greening the industry is that if you're going to take something away, you need to give something to. So we try to look for offsets. Like, if we're going to, you know, if we're going to ask them to do this, then maybe we can save them money doing that.
Hey Meredith, let's talk about a specific example, because you just had one, and you and Katie, your partner, Katie Carpenter, just did a panel for the Producers Guild of America with Peter Seraph. And Lydia Dean Pilcher, Peter just produced "Away We Go," which is out now. It's a very with Maya Rudolph. This is a very specific.
And the guy from The Office.
And the guy from The Office.
Kaczynski.
Yeah, so you have specific numbers of how you tell us about specifically how you green that. What was the process in that production?
Well, some of the things that we achieved on that, we used biodiesel in all three locations. And actually using biodiesel in the East, biodiesel is cheaper in the East, and you have to be very careful with how you're doing it. So when we green, we always are very, you know, outgoing and you know, we're very open to talking to the vendors. It's better to green the existing vendors and try to get a movie industry to use a new vendor. Mm-hmm. So we talked to the vendors, and they were willing to use biodiesel, and they actually saved about 30 cents for every gallon of fuel they used. Mm. And that was a pretty impressive, you know, they used it.
Oh, that's huge. Producers love that.
Huge. And, you know, it was B5 in some places, B20, and then B99 in others, which made me nervous. But, you know, it was really, you know, biodiesel's not the answer, but it's one of the solutions. You know, if you can get people to start trying new fuels, that was a step in the right direction.
Also, your vehicles, and talk about your water bottles.
The vehicles, we rented hybrid cars about 45% of the time, so 150 hybrid cars were rented during the shoot. And that was pretty significant. You know, transportation is a huge part of production. You know, whether it's the set dressers driving miles and miles for that perfect table, or the props people, or even the wardrobe people, just getting people back and forth to the airport, you're saving money there.
Yeah, there's like a little department for each of those transportation.
Right, and what you spend on the hybrid, because sometimes there's an upcharge for the hybrid, you save on gas.
Yeah. It would be funny if you tried to recommend that all films be filmed completely at the airport.
Well, actually, you know, that's actually not a bad idea. I know Jamaica, Queens
there?
Is trying to redevelop itself into, like, you know, proximity to the airport. They should open a big studio out there.
Yeah, New Yorkers like having films filmed in their locations, but a lot of the time it's headache. You can't park your cars there.
And the neighborhood, you're always arguing with the community a lot of times. There's something called the Studio 6 as well, Meredith. You want to talk about that a little bit?
The Studio 6 is it's lathes of the major studios, including Paramount, Sony, Fox, NBC, Universal, Disney, and the heads of the studios often come together to talk about, you know, where they are in the environmental arena. It's a really innovative, you know, approach to industries really taking hold and deciding to, we are really going to change ourselves and our culture. And, you know, the PGA also has been quite, instrumental in this process.
Producers Guild of America, is that?
Yes, the Producers Guild of America has really taken the reins. I mean, they have a wonderful PGA Goes Green site. They have helped to...
PGAGreen.org. Actually, Meredith, when we were talking... We were talking about earlier, Ed had mentioned, and Patrick as well, about the Producers Guild, like the building trades, like LEED is trying to get, you know, is trying to figure out a certification to you know, for efficiencies and to call a set green and what that exactly means and what the metrics are of that.
Yeah, I think they're a ways off. I mean, as you know, a movie can be any, you know, there it could be
it's so wide, right?
Yeah,
it's so wide.
Topics.
Right.
So the production elements in that, whether it be special effects or transportation, I mean, it can vary so completely, not only in terms of, like, content, but just even how and when and the time frame that you have for actually producing a movie. I don't know how far off that is. I know that the EMA is working towards green seals. I believe that I've heard, some talent being involved in creating their own sort of green seal. I'm sure there's something going on in Europe, but I think at this point it's not quite there yet. But, you know, hopefully there's a seal for everything.
Well, you've inspired this station to stop actually doing a full-on explosion every time we use sound effect and to actually just use the sound effect. So. That's the first time we actually didn't blow something up.
I'm curious, though, will the move towards digital from film make any difference? You know, because developing film is not necessarily the most environmentally friendly activity.
No, and that's post-production, really, and there is a huge push towards that. I don't know if, you know, real film, motion picture film, is ready to make that jump yet. And TV, as I've been told, uses film quite a bit to archive itself.
Okay.
So I don't think we're quite there yet, but there has been movements in this generation of younger filmmakers who have been using their Macs for so much, and Apple being such a leading competitor in this field, mm-hmm. I think you're going to see a lot more online, you know, editing going on.
Interesting.
Like Avid. Remember, Mark, when we first worked together?
Yeah, Patrick, you know that story. Like Avid, I don't want to say anything bad on the air.
It was the first non-linear editing machine,
yes,
right?
Yes, it was, and there it should have remained. but that's enough about. That's why I use Final Cut Pro right now. Anyway, so I just quickly, we have about a minute left.
Yeah,
Meredith, I just wanted to go back to Away We Go. Just tell us about where that shot and what efficiencies you sort of prevented or inefficiencies you prevented.
Well, we prevented about 49% of the waste going to a landfill.
Wow.
And that was pretty significant considering it was a very much, on location film. We did everything from, you know, donating compost to local organic farms. Catering was organic. We featured, like, you know, the local meal, local meal of the day. We saved about 14,000 plastic water bottles from using metal water bottles.
Wow.
So that was pretty significant. And it was pretty tough because it, you know, it is a on-the-road film. And it's not easy to get people to let go.
Yeah. How many locations? Where did you guys go? What location?
Three locations. It was Connecticut. It was Florida. And it was Arizona.
Hmm. Well, I have to say, I hope A.O. Scott's listening because I don't know if you read his little review of the film. But one of his complaints was that it was a little too smug and self-righteous for his liking. But it seems like not only was the acting and the story smug and self-righteous, the production rightly can be smug and self-righteous.
We were pretty proud. I mean, Mary Jo Winkler, who was the line producer and executive producer for this film.
Producer Guild America.
Yep, and yes. Jane Evans, for that
yes.
matter.
Jane Evans.
Are real, you know, incredibly amazing individuals who really, you know, walk the walk. And they're inspiring in how much they really believe in this and how much they have helped to push the industry go in this direction and really, really truly mm-hmm. believe in it. And have taken it, you know, they take it on to every, you know, it's not just one production they do this. They do this on every production they do. And, you know, Jane Evans, a Focus film, she's the VP of production there, mm-hmm. physical production. She's just really... You know, those are two people who are just really worthy of just calling, you know, environmental heroes. Yeah. I mean, really amazing people.
Yeah.
It was an honor to work with them. It was really fun. They were open to new ideas.
What's your next project?
Well, we currently work with several studios.
Tell
right now.
Tell us the
we
name of your company again and its website.
Green Media Solutions, and it's greenmediasolutions.net. And if people want a total report on the film and how much we offset and the total carbon count and... If you really get into those details, you can go to greenmediasolutions.net and download a copy of the report.
Very Obama.
Yeah, I know. I should be a little less, you know, proud of it, but I am incredibly
proud.
No,
you
proud.
It's you the should only, be super proud.
The though. Only way you can fight the big guys, you know, is to be traceable. So, you know, you can be traceable and not that people have to go to the information, but it's nice to know that it's there.
It's there.
Well, this movie really inspired, I think, you know, NBC to take some steps into really changing, you know, changing yeah. its thoughts on green. And green is universal from NBC.
Talk about 30 Rock.
Yeah, well, 30 Rock, well, we work at 30 Rock. We don't work on 30 Rock, a different production, which, by the way, I hear is very, very green as well. I believe that the producers there have taken really that to a new level.
Yay, Tina Fey.
Tina!
Yeah, I mean, really impressive.
I'd love
really
to
impressive.
Have her on Monday.
I think, you know, I forget the name of the producer right now, but she has really taken some strides in greening her set. But NBC Green is Universal has taken that as well, and we're working to help them create green guidelines for all their productions, both TV and film. And, you know, working with the producers and then sort of creating a guide that's sort of spoken back to them in a green manner, so to help them produce more environmentally. And then we have two other major motion pictures going on in the city right now with two other studios.
Who's in it?
I can't say. I'm not allowed to say anything yet.
You didn't by chance film at Del Posto last Sunday, did you?
Well, I'm trying to think. Did they?
You're probably not affiliated with it, but that was Meryl Streep and Alec Baldwin, and it did allow for the Del Posto staff to take Sunday off, and they chose to come to Roberta's, where they had a big lunch here. So I'm sure you know nothing about that. But.
Oh, I know nothing about that. But yeah, that's it. That's some of the production that we've actually, you know, spoken with, and they've done amazing things. Actually, that's the Nancy Myers production that's under Universal right now. They've done incredible, incredible work. They actually donated 2 tons of organic food. They did a scene out in L.A. in Santa Barbara with a farmer's market. And instead of, you know, getting rid of all that food, what they did was they donated to soup kitchens and fed about 500 people for an entire week.
Wow.
With that food.
It's amazing. Like, you think about that and how much has been wasted and how much, you know, could still be being wasted if that's how much is being saved. You know, it's amazing. Numbers.
You could turn the craft table with a K, which is crazy that's called the craft table.
Craft.
I mean, that talk about mediocre food. But maybe you could turn it into the craft table with the C.
Yeah. It's been amazing to watch these guys. And then they also donated a lot of their plants to L.A. area high schools. They've used biodiesel in the production. They've been pretty aggressive as well.
And if you named it the craft table with the C, you're saving ink. I think a C uses less.
Oh, just let it go.
That's true. Crafty.
Crafty.
Like
everybody loves Crafty.
Everybody, yeah. I always amazing. Say the two most important people on the set are makeup and Crafty. Makeup is the first person to touch your talent. And Crafty, you know, all the crew, everybody's looking
it
forward
keeps
towards.
Everybody from being too cranky.
Yeah, everybody's looking forward to a good meal, and if it's bad, you're in trouble.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, it's so true.
Meredith, can you come back and be a live guest on the show here?
I'd love to do that. I'm local, so I don't have to, and I can take public transportation.
Excellent.
We'd love to have you back. And
love
not
to come
and
back.
To not tell us about more actors that you're working with.
Aren't I so good about that?
You're good.
I learned my lesson early.
Well, this has been.
I'd love to come back, and I'd love to bring my partner as well.
Yeah, love to have Katie.
Well, guys, this has been a great show. I mean, it was really a topic I knew very little bit about, but we're going to use this green building thing as a launching point to green spaces.
Yes, and Gabe, for next week.
Gabe's talking to a few people in
the
city
with
department.
All the greenways and, like, Governor's Island and stuff. Yeah.
Exactly, and I'm sweet. Very interested in Olmsted and the building of the parks.
The High Line.
The High Line, yeah.
Yeah, the High Line should be a big one. I think, yeah. Didn't that just open?
Just opened
last weekend, yeah.
I'm going to go this
week.
Yeah,
why don't you get your friend MB to come in because he was part of the opening ceremonies.
MB? Yeah. I should.
Michael Bloomberg.
Redder hair and a little bit more girth.
And he wears Crocs.
Yep.
Mario Batali.
Oh! That
who's very
better.
Green, and by the way, I think they do amazing stuff at Del Posto, but we should, and it's so big, I think it qualifies as a space, Del Posto.
he qualifies as a space, certainly.
Oh, my God. That's it. Well, guys, great show, and we look forward to providing you many more entertaining Q reports in the future.
Okay.
Hey.
Tune in next week and keep on searching.
Yep. Have a great week.
Thanks for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
Regulators. We regulate any stealing of his property. We're damn good, too. But you can't be any geek off the street. Gotta be handy with the steel, if you know what I mean. Earn your keep.
Regulators! Mount up!
It was a clear black night, a clear white moon. Warren G was on the streets, trying to consume some skirts for the E, so I could get some phones. Rolling in my ride, chilling all alone.
Just hit the east side of the LBC, on a mission trying to find Mr. Warren G. Seen a car full of girls, ain't no need to tweak. All you search know what's up with 213.
So I hooked a left on 21 and Lewis, some brothers shooting dice, so I said, let's do this. I jumped out the rock and said, what's up? Some brothers pulled some gas, so I said, I'm stuck.
Since these girls peeping me, I'm on glide and swerve. These hookers looking so hard, they straight hit the curve. Want to bigger, better things than some horny tricks. I see my homie and some suckers all in his mix.
I'm getting jacked, I'm breaking myself. I can't believe they taking Warren 12. They took my rings, they took my Rolex. I looked at the brother, said, damn, what's next?
They got my homie hemmed up and they all around. Can't none of them see him if they going straight pound for pound. They want to come up real quick before they start to clown. I best pull out my strap and lay them busters down.
They got guns to my head, I think I'm going down. I can't believe it's happening in my own town.
If I had wings, I would fly. Let me contemplate. I glance in the cut and I see my homie Nate. 16 in the clip and one in the hole. Nate Dogg is about to make somebody's turn cold. Now they dropping and yelling, it's a tad bit late. Nate Dogg and Warren G had to regulate.